Al Jazeera Podcasts.
Today, Jeffrey Epstein was trying to reshape the Middle East.
All the people that fell into his web, they were all essentially commodities to him, traded for the advantage of one single cause, which is Israel.
How a convicted sex offender leveraged his money and contacts to advance Israel's agenda and his own. I'm Kevin Hurton, and this is The Take. Today's episode zooms in on an overlooked part of the Epstein files. We're looking at how he worked as a middleman, and sometimes almost like a diplomat, securing connections and businesses between powerful players. Different governments, different interests. But before we continue, tell us what angle of this monumental affair you think we should look at next. We're always looking for your input. If you enjoyed this perspective, don't forget to rate the show 5 stars. It helps tremendously.
Well, I'm Craig Mokaiber. I'm an international human rights lawyer and analyst, served for over 3 decades at the United Nations and stepped down from my post at the UN headquarters in New York in October of 2023. And we are speaking from New York.
Okay, so Craig, thank you for coming on The Take. And it's really great to have you on the show today. But before we drill down on Epstein and Israel specifically, I did want to introduce you a bit to our audience. So can you just tell me a little bit about the work that you did for the UN?
Sure. Well, I spent more than 3 decades at the United Nations with postings and missions in countries around the globe, including, by the way, in Palestine, where I undertook several human rights missions. But my final post before stepping down in October of 2023 was as director of the Human Rights Office at United Nations headquarters in New York.
And you made headlines on October 28th, 2023, and that was just 3 weeks into Israel's genocide on Gaza, when you wrote a resignation letter to the UN High Commission for Human Rights. In it, you said the United Nations was failing in its duty to prevent the genocide. I would say that 3 years later, that counts as prescient. So when we look back, when future generations look back on all of the ways that the UN failed the Palestinians during this period, will it be because it was powerless to oppose Israel or simply chose not to?
Well, I think it's the latter. There are periods in the UN's history, particularly in the 1960s and 70s and into the 1980s, where the UN consistently took a very principled stand on Palestine based upon international law, on international human rights. But beginning with the start of the Oslo process in the early 1990s, that began to shift in the UN, where notions of political expediency began to trump international norms and standards about what was happening in Palestine. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of pressure. I was there during those years to sort of, tone down critique of the Israeli regime, even during its worst periods of atrocity, and to simply defer to the peace process, defer to the Americans and the Israelis effectively. And that downward spiral continued, I think, to weaken the response of the United Nations to the situation in Palestine, leading, I think, ultimately to the genocide.
Yeah, okay. So here's what I want to introduce to this story, the figure of Jeffrey Epstein, the now deceased financier and convicted sex offender. Now, he's been dead since 2019, but the Epstein story is very much alive, as you know. The Epstein files have been dominating the news cycle all over the world, especially in the wake of this latest drop of 3 million documents by the U.S. Department of Justice. And Craig, the extent of Jeffrey Epstein's reach in all corners of elite circles is just stunning. I mean, we're talking higher education, finance, royalty, international relations. So among the thousands of names mentioned in the files, there's two that had an outsized role, I would say, in shaping the past and the current contours of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And we're talking about Mona Yule and Terje Rud Larsen. Tell us who they are and what the files reveal about their connection to Epstein.
Yeah. Well, I think what the files reveal is that Epstein clearly had his eye on the United Nations for quite some time. There's one exchange between Epstein and Steve Bannon where he's urging Steve Bannon to come to New York for the United Nations General Assembly. And he refers to the UN General Assembly as the Super Bowl, underscoring the importance of that annual UN gathering for his own networking goals as well. The documents also revealed, by the way, that Epstein had somehow obtained confidential internal documents from the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in his communications. We know that one president of the UN General Assembly, Miroslav Lajcak, who's the former president of the GIA, but also a former Slovak foreign minister. He was in regular correspondence with Jeffrey Epstein, including while he was serving at the UN those years. He ultimately was compelled to resign out of a scandal around the Epstein releases.
Yeah.
But as you say, the most important UN revelation so far in the Epstein files relates to Mona Yule and Terje Rode Larsen.
I talked to both Israeli negotiators and Palestinian negotiators, and eventually I came to the understanding that the way it was organized in Washington couldn't possibly succeed.
This is a Norwegian husband and wife team who were the architects of the, I think I can say it, disastrous Oslo process. Mm. And it's important because, you know, their close relations to Epstein and his role as kind of an Israeli asset is important because history shows that Oslo was effectively a diplomatic smokescreen.
The Oslo Accords were a series of agreements signed between 1993 and 1999 with a goal that aimed to see Israel withdraw from the territories it occupied. And so most Palestinians believe that the Accords would create an independent Palestinian state in the occupied territories alongside Israel. But that never happened.
It sidestepped international law. It devastated Palestinian rights for three decades. It consolidated Israel's unlawful position in Palestine. And these main architects of Oslo, Larsen and Yule, they're revealed in the files as having very close personal long-term relations with Epstein. Larsen took substantial personal loans from Epstein, and the children of Larsen and Yule were reportedly left $10 million in Epstein's will.
That's unbelievable.
Then you have...
And Larsen, yeah. just to interrupt, Larsen was briefly your boss at one point at the UN.
He was during my posting for 2 years in the 1990s in Gaza. He was the UN special coordinator, the senior envoy for Israel and Palestine. I worked briefly under his supervision there. And then he later left and headed the International Peace Institute, which is a think tank across the street from the UN and very much affiliated with the UN, where these files also suggest that he was facilitating internships for allegedly unqualified young women from Eastern Europe, and at least some of the cases sharing their photos with Epstein in personal communications. So remember, Larsen was the UN's chief envoy for the Middle East, what they, was called UNSCO in those days. And he was later forced to step down from the Peace Institute because of his dealings with Epstein. Yeah. But even after Oslo, he was also implicated in efforts to try to advance Trump's so-called Abraham Accords ruse, which I think viewers will know is basically a U.S.-Israel scheme to erase the Palestinian issue from regional and global politics. Yeah. And consolidate the normalization of Israel's. And all of this raises a lot of eyebrows at the UN because there's this sense that Larsen, and in fact, all of his successors as UN envoys at UNSCO, they were perceived as being too close to the Israeli regime to the detriment of the Palestinians. And all of them, from Larsen on, consistently prioritized Israel regime sensibilities over international law and the human rights of the Palestinians. And that was very frustrating to UN human rights officials, for example, with whom UNSCO has often been in conflict. And now just, you know, on this point, equally shockingly, Larsen's most recent successor at UNSCO, Nikolay Mladenov, has even agreed to serve on Trump's lawless colonial so-called Board of Peace.
Yeah.
Which itself, I think, is a direct affront to the Palestinian people.
I saw that, yeah. Norway did suspend Mona Yule as Norway's ambassador to Jordan and Iraq over Ambassador Mona Yule's contacts with Jeffrey Epstein. So there was some accountability there.
They did.
So let's examine Epstein's own connections with the Israelis. There have been, you know, theories swirling around for years that he was an intelligence asset, possibly working for the Russians or Mossad. You don't go that far, but you do describe him as a Mossad-adjacent Israeli regime operative. What do you mean by that?
Well, we know he was at least an asset of the Mossad. It seems to me the evidence that's been laid out now is beyond question. Whether or not he was, you know, on the employee roles of Mossad, if any such thing exists. I mean, that's a question we don't have an answer to. But the documents, releases and investigations, they revealed that he operated principally as an intermediary for Israeli interests. Hmm. And that he had very privileged and very intimate connections to Israeli politicians, especially Ehud Barak, the former prime minister, but also Israeli spies like Yoni Korin, who frequently stayed for weeks at a time in Epstein's New York apartment. as well as his close relationship and engagement with major collaborators in Israel's military and intelligence infrastructure, like Palantir, for example.
He explained what Palantir was to Ehud Barak. We'll get to him in a second, but you know.
Yes, he did. He did. And neither one of them seemed to be able to spell any of the names involved, including Palantir.
P-A-L-A-N-T-I-E-L?
Yes.
How do you write Thiele? T-H-I-E-L-L-Y?
T-H-I-E-L.
L-L-Y?
No. T-H-I-E-L-L.
Okay.
So he thought that Peter would put you on the board of Palantir. Peter Thiele is one of the best.
So that's interesting. But that became an absolutely key contact over time.
Yeah, absolutely. Ehud Barak. He was Israel's prime minister from 1999 to 2001. Then he was defense minister from 2007 to 2013. What have we learned about his relationship with Epstein?
Well, it was close. It was intimate. It was longstanding. Remember, Ehud Barak was not just the former prime minister. He was the former minister of defense, as you say, head of military intelligence, very closely connected with Israeli intelligence. And he was one of Epstein's closest associates. He met with Epstein dozens of times, long after, by the way, Epstein's 2008 sex crimes conviction. He was often on his private jet, on his island, and his various properties. They were actually partners in security tech startups. Epstein helped Barak with a range of business ventures, ranging from oil deals to an Israeli drone company. He was even involved, by the way, in Barak's political comeback against Netanyahu in 2019. And with Barak, he helped Israel facilitate agreements with other countries trying to build Israel's profile. So an agreement with Côte d'Ivoire for Israeli surveillance and tech, an agreement with the Mongolian government to promote Israeli military equipment and surveillance tech, even to facilitating communications between Barak and Putin to advance Israel's goals in the Syrian war.
That's incredible. Just pause there. Yeah. Epstein is facilitating a meeting between a former Israeli prime minister and the president of Russia. Like, he has that power.
He has that power, and he had that role very clearly. He was sort of an unofficial ambassador who could use this network that they had created together to be kind of a front man, an advance man for the Israeli regime. And that extended, you know, virtually everywhere in the global south, all across Western Asia, Arab governments, in Europe, all across Western Europe and Eastern Europe, and including apparently in Russia. We don't know what came of it ultimately, but those contacts were clearly revealed.
We'll have more with Craig after a break. So, Craig, let's talk about Jeffrey Epstein and the Abraham Accords, because Epstein died in his jail cell in 2019, which is before the UAE, Morocco, and Bahrain officially normalized ties with Israel. But new documents reveal that there was a lot of work going on behind the scenes early on, especially through his contact with an Emirati port magnate, that's Sultan bin Sulayem. Now, we talked about Epstein as this connector. Can we say now that this connection with Sulayem helped pave the way for Israel and UAE normalizing relation?
I think it's unquestionable. Epstein was a key actor in creating the template for the so-called Abraham Accords, and the laboratory was the UAE. Mm. You know, these Abraham Accords, for viewers who don't know, these are effectively a U.S.-Israeli scheme to basically erase Palestinian rights from the Middle East equation and to normalize the Israeli regime through business and other kind of connections. Even as the Israeli regime is perpetrating illegal occupation, apartheid, and genocide with impunity. And based on these newly leaked documents, we know that Epstein spent years acting as an intermediary, cultivating business and security ties between Israel and the UAE. That was the blueprint years before the Abraham Accords were officially signed. He brokered high-level meetings between Israeli officials and Emirati business leaders, facilitating technology deals, leveraging his network to advance Israeli interest across the Middle East. But most important, as you mentioned, he brokered meetings between Ehud Barak and Sultan Ahmed bin Sulayem, who was the CEO of this Dubai-based DP World, a global logistics and ports management company.
It's a huge company.
And the emails show a very close personal relationship between Epstein and bin Sulayem. I mean, the two were sharing dirty jokes and porn images and personal information about themselves. And Epstein worked to facilitate investments by Sulayem in Israeli logistics infrastructure. He promoted Israeli cyber weapons and surveillance tech for use in Emirati-controlled, you know, infrastructure and port security. And we know that Bin Salem visited Epstein's private island, and then a neighboring island was actually purchased under his name. So in this way, Epstein helped to build the covert foundations for commercial and intelligence cooperation that later became the Abraham Accords. And all of that for the purpose of strengthening Israel's position and weakening the Palestinian cause.
Yeah, it's just worth reminding people, all of this was happening after 2008, after he became a registered sex offender. Have you seen this photograph that's emerged of Sulaim and Epstein inspecting a piece of the Kiswa? That's the black silk cloth that covers the Kaaba and Mecca. I mean, this is a sacred artifact sent to the United States. Yeah. In this part of the world, it's certainly sparking outrage.
Absolutely, as it should.
Yeah. So there's been a very productive relationship. In December 2025, the UAE signed a $2.3 billion defense deal with Elbit Systems, which is one of the largest arms sales in Israeli history. So, you know, this is the fruit of all of that effort. Craig, this Epstein story is clearly not going away, despite the very concerted efforts of the Trump administration and its allies. The outrage is real, and it's sustained, which is you know, rare these days. One reason, I think, is because these files show that the rules don't apply to everyone. And that's the feeling that's been building in political movements on both the left and the right, especially in the wake of Israel's war on Gaza. Do you see the connection there? Does Israel's genocidal assault on the Palestinians make more sense now that we've peeled back the curtain with some of these Epstein files?
Absolutely. You know, we're living in a period where we're seeing serial aggression, was supposed to be the crime of crimes by both the U.S. and the Israeli regime, the imposition of unlawful sanctions on countries and individuals, the murder and destruction of boats in the Caribbean, the invasion of Venezuela, the abduction of its leader, an ongoing live stream genocide in Palestine for more than 2 years, the open complicity of other states across Europe and in Western Asia. Ultimately, this unlawful Security Council Resolution 2803, setting up, you know, Trump's Board of Peace, that I have said represents the final surrender of the international system to the abusive power of the U.S.-Israel axis. And I think unless there is a dramatic turnaround, and soon, this will be the beginning of the end for things like the UN and international law, which, by the way, is a goal that has long been sought by the Israeli regime. Mm. And now in a world defined by brute force, impunity, cowardice, complicity, you know, it appears it's getting its wish. And you talk about the outrage, Kevin, that people are feeling. One of the things that we're seeing in the West is that Western media corporations are now trying to manage this, right? They have a history of running cover for Israel. They're now doing kind of damage control around Epstein. You know, they're scrambling to manage what is the public understanding of the Epstein files.
Can you say more about that? I mean, the system revealed by the Epstein files is going to fight to preserve itself. How do you see that playing out?
I mean, it's quite visible and I think quite outrageous if you watch some Western media these days. You know, what we know from the evidence, what the facts present, is the systematic corruption of U.S., U.K. and other governments, media, social media and businesses by proxies of this foreign regime, Israel. But what the Western media has been doing is they've been framing the story. First, they tried to frame it as a scandalous tale of a wealthy sexual pervert, financier and pedophile, and some of his rich and powerful friends. But then as more political details started to emerge about the role that he was playing, they tried to shift and this now familiar narrative, blame the Russians, even though there is nothing to suggest in the Epstein files that he was principally concerned with Russian interests. Rather, what we know for certain was that Jeffrey Epstein was a very committed Zionist. By the way, these things even reveal that he was a Jewish supremacist, as made clear by a number of racist exchanges in the emails, but that his principal cause was that of the Israeli regime. And in fact, beyond his own, yes, undeniable arrogance and bigotry and ego and hedonism, right? What all the documents reveal is that the money, the weapons, the security tech, the spying, the sex, the pedophilia, you know, Epstein's extensive network, his horrific abuse of women and girls, and all the people that fell into his web, they were all essentially commodities to him, traded for the advantage of one single cause, which is Israel. That was the motive. And we know he had, you know, extensive high-level connections to the Israeli regime, to its government, to security, intelligence, its financing circles, its business community. That was the means that went with the motive. So this is not some story of a lone sex offender or a new Russiagate, as Western media corporations are trying to convince us. It's a story about Israeli influence in the highest corridors of power and wealth.
Yeah, no, that's why this latest drop is, it feels different, because there are really two stories happening simultaneously. There's obviously the depraved trafficking of underage girls, which, you know, but what this latest drop shows is the absolute rot at the heart of elite institutions. You've watched it up close. You've seen the decay. You were talking earlier that in the 1980s, the UN would stand up for things, and then it just stopped after Oslo. Does it feel like the international order has been destroyed, or did it commit suicide?
Well, I think there was plenty of internal complicity in its own destruction. But there have been powerful forces operating for many years. And interestingly, where we saw those most visibly was in successive U.S. governments that were always trying to weaken, contain, obstruct the United Nations in its activities around peace and security. We see it with the U.S. veto repeatedly, right? But also around human rights, about global development and so on. The U.S. always used the United Nations as a tool when it was useful to it, but obstructed it when it didn't like any of its purposes. It was never committed to a kind of universal normative mission of the U.N., and has always been committed to might makes right. What we see with the Trump administration is they've sort of stripped away all of the smoke and mirrors and are just openly imperial, colonial as well. Israel is the other force that has for years tried to weaken the United Nations, tried to find, carve out exceptions to international law. And, you know, there was a period of time when other member states of the UN stood up to try to make sure that that erosion didn't continue so openly. We are now in a period of unparalleled complicity, where we see country after country, region after region, effectively bowing down to the empire. And as I said, the pinnacle of that was the adoption of Security Council 2803, which erased 80 years of international law, of international resolutions, of the rights of the Palestinian people. And as if we are operating in colonial times, handed the survivors of a genocide in Gaza over to one of the perpetrators with the intimate involvement of the other perpetrator, which is to say that the survivors of Gaza, their future, their human rights are now in the hands of the U.S. and Israel, which have dedicated themselves to the destruction of the Palestinian people. And the world, including the Security Council, including Europe, including countries of Western Asia, have gone along with this. First, in complicit silence, and now with an affirmative act in the Security Council of mandating 19th century colonialism in the 21st century.
All right. I think we could leave it there. Craig, thank you for coming on The Take today.
Kevin, thank you for having me.